Snoop Dogg was once on trial for murder. Now he's on top of the world.
I just wanted to be the dopest MC in the world.
He's been a gangsta, a pimp, the self-proclaimed reincarnation of Bob Marley, and everything in between.
You've managed to make a career out of being yourself.
Yeah, but that's the easiest job everybody got, just to wake up in the morning and do you.
He's more than a rapper. Love him or hate him, he's still an absolute legend.
If you don't like it, don't listen to it. If you like it, love it. If you don't, f*** you.
This is the story of Snoop Dogg. Calvin Cortazar Broaddus Jr. entered the world on October 20th, 1971, in Long Beach, California. His mom, Beverly Tate, and dad, Vernell Varnado, were his first family, but things didn't start smoothly. Vernell Varnado, who was a war vet, left the family when Calvin was just 3 months old. Of him, Snoop told Spin back in 1993, "Growing up, I'd see him like 6 or 7 times a year." Vernell himself confessed to OC Weekly that he was mostly a voice on the other end of the phone during Snoop's childhood, having moved to Detroit to chase a new life. Thing is, Vernell was chasing his own dream of becoming a gospel singer, but ended up working as a postal worker instead. Years later, however, when Snoop made it big, he didn't hold a grudge against him. Instead, he helped his dad get involved in the music biz. Varnado became the co-owner of a small record label, and Snoop gave him some songs to include on a compilation album.
Were you guys close?
Well, Snoop's mother raised him. Mm-hmm. And me, I really didn't see Snoop a whole lot, but from the time he was 12 up until right now, just like that.
But going back to his childhood after Vernell left the family, Calvin's stepdad, Calvin Cortazar Broaddus Sr., became the new man of the house, and the baby took his name. But it was Snoop's mom who gave him the nickname Snoopy.
Tell them where Snoop Doggy Dogg comes from.
Come from Mom's. My mama gave me that name, you know what I'm saying? She used to call me Snoopy, you know what I'm saying? But I just put the Doggy Dogg in there to give it that added flavor, so you know what I'm saying? It can have a twist with it.
Yeah, now why did she start calling you Snoopy?
I can't tell, probably because I used to look like a dog.
By 1975, when Snoop was only 4 years old, his mom and stepdad had split up too. Broaddus was raised in the Baptist faith, where he cut his musical teeth by singing and playing piano at Golgotha Trinity Baptist Church from a young age. His mother, a choir member, was a huge musical influence, filling their home with the sounds of classic R&B.
I thank my mother for this. She taught me to be me as a kid. She used to let me come in the living room and dance with her friends and perform on Sundays and do speeches and, you know, different plays. She taught me how to play the piano, put me in different things to where I had to get to know how to be around people.
But faith in music didn't pay the bills.
The struggle that I went through, that my mother went through, I didn't want my kids to have that. I wanted them to understand that it's okay to struggle, but I want to help you avoid some of the things in life that I did and teach you what I was taught, but show you how to get to the top a little bit faster than I was able to.
With his mom struggling as a single parent, Snoop had to hustle early, bagging groceries and running a paper route to help keep the lights on.
Then I started selling candy. I started selling newspapers. I had to go door to door, had to learn how to communicate. All of these different skills that I learned showed me how to be around people.
When he noticed several of his homies were selling drugs instead of candies, Snoop figured his chances of making real money were worth the next step he took. He became associated with the Rollin' 20s Crips gang in Long Beach's East Side neighborhood, although in 1993, he denied ever officially joining a gang. Snoop was arrested for drug peddling only 30 days after his graduation from Long Beach Polytechnic High School in 1989. Over the next 3 years, he would be in and out of county jails. Even during his hustling days, Snoop never lost his passion for music. He kept a close eye on the careers of N.W.A., Eric B. and Rakim, and his favorite rapper, Slick Rick. Snoop and Slick Rick share a lot in common. Both have unique voices and rhyme styles that changed hip-hop. Both are storytellers, whether serious or funny, about life in the streets, and both spent time behind bars. Hoping for a record deal, with Nate Dogg and Warren G, he recorded Homemade Tapes. Their group was called 213, after the area code of their native Long Beach at that time.
When I presented myself in the music industry, I had just, you know, recently had been released from selling cocaine. I was a drug seller.
Despite being broke and unemployed, Snoop was determined to make it as a rapper, even if it meant borrowing money, relying on friends for food, and crashing on any couch he could find. One of those tapes ended up in Dr. Dre's hands, thanks to Warren G, who also happened to be Dre's brother.
I used to be in a group called 213, me, Warren G, and Nate Dogg, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And we just, you know, just do underground tapes in Long Beach, striving, struggling, trying to get up out the ghetto. And Warren G gave one to Dre, he liked it and took it from there. And it was like, you know, start writing and take it from there.
Yeah.
This would change everything.
Dr. Dre was the perfect father figure, role model, mentor, and producer for me at the time because I was young, I was raw, but I needed direction and I needed some sculpting. And he was able to shape me and mold me and teach me the right way of how to do it. And he had the right team around me. And I've always respected the fact that he was willing to teach me when I was not who I am today. You know, people see the Snoop Dogg that's polished up and shined up, but they didn't see the one that was a rock, that he seen the diamond in me. And I appreciate him for that. I want to thank him right now for that.
Right.
The first time I heard Snoop, a friend of mine had a bachelor party. I've met Snoop before that. He was selling drugs, and our stepbrother Warren G propped his tape in. I'm like, man, this is a fucking diamond in the rough, and we need to polish it up.
So Warren G goes to the bachelor party with our cassette. Music stopped. He throw the cassette in. The cassette banging. Everybody at the party like, who is that? He like, that's my homeboy Snoop. So the next day, Dr. Dre called and like, nigga, I like what was on the tape. Come to the studio.
The then 21-year-old Snoop was quickly signed to the Death Row label, where Dr. Dre immediately took him under his wing as his protege. Snoop and Dr. Dre first joined forces on the theme song for the 1992 film Deep Cover.
And the Deep Cover soundtrack, it came about, and he was like, I need a song for this soundtrack. I'm finna go to the gym. When I get back, I need the song to be done. I'm like, well, what's the movie about? What's the soundtrack about? He like, shit, he called the company. It's about an undercover cop selling, somebody selling dope to an undercover cop. And I'm like, damn, I got caught for selling dope to an undercover cop. That's how I went to jail. So I'm like, all right, cool, I got it.
But it was their work on Dre's game-changing debut solo album, The Chronic, that truly made people pay attention to Snoop. The Chronic features many voices besides Dr. Dre's. Interestingly, he actually has only one solo track on the album. The rest of the album is filled with his supporting cast, each bringing their own style. RBX sounds like a villain, Daz bridges West Coast hip-hop's past and present, and Lady of Rage raps like the toughest of them all. But through all of this, Snoop's voice undeniably stood out. His flow was both fierce and laid back, with his presence coming off as both intimidating and welcoming at the same time. His breakout moment on Nothing But a G Thing showed exactly why Shoe Knight and Dre saw him as the cornerstone of their music empire.
That's the first song that we put out. We recorded G Thing before that.
Oh, did you? Obviously, that's what I
Yeah, but I had a motherfucking toothache, and I went and got some pills from my auntie and violated my probation and had to go to jail for like 4 months.
For real?
So that prolonged that shit, yep.
So y'all shot G Thing, then you got locked up?
We recorded G-Thing first, then I got locked up, then I got out, and then we did Deep Cover, and Deep Cover came out first, and then we re-recorded G-Thing once my shit had got healed, because my voice was, like, fucked up, but once my shit had got healed, my shit was crisp as a motherfucker. I heard that shit in
in my earphone. I'm like, this nigga Dr. Dre is the shit, cuz. My shit sounded clean. Like, one, two, three, and to the four. That shit was, like, crystal clear.
In 1993, Los Angeles was a city still smoldering from the fires of the L.A. riots.
Dramatic videotape obtained by Channel 5 News shows what appears to be a group of LAPD officers beating a suspect.
As soon as it hit the air,
the Rodney King case had laid bare the ugly face of police brutality, turning the city into a battlefield where the long-ignored and enraged African-American community finally struck back against the oppression woven into the fabric of their lives. The chaos ignited when a jury let four LAPD officers walk free, despite the world seeing the brutal beating of Rodney King on camera.
Four officers on trial, Lawrence Powell was by far the most aggressive on the video.
This was a managed and controlled use of force. It followed the policies and procedures of the Los Angeles Police Department and the training.
You smell like alcohol!
Hey,
anyway.
Hey, get that camera out of my face, okay?
The verdict was gasoline on a flame, and for 6 days, the streets of Los Angeles were consumed by violence and desperation. Amidst this raw, unfiltered reality, Snoop Dogg dropped his debut album, Doggy Style, a soundtrack to a city filled with rage.
Snoop Dogg changed the world with Doggy Style, man. Snoop Dogg, that was one of the biggest albums, one of the best albums, not just rap albums, best music albums that ever came out. He changed the game, man. And,
debuting at number one on the Billboard charts, the album catapulted Snoop into global superstardom.
I just wanted to be the dopest MC in the world. That's all I was pushing for at the time. And Dr. Dre had a vision because he got a chance to hang out with me. And by hanging out with me, he had learned who I was. And he knew I was into a lot of 70s and old school black exploitation. And when we would ride together, I would always have a cassette with old school songs on it. And I would always control the music from the passenger seat. So he started to figure me out while we was working on the Chronic.
For a long time, the East Coast held hip-hop's crown. But with the rise of Death Row Records, thanks to Snoop and Dre, California took the lead.
They need no introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Dre and Snoop Doggy Dogg.
Seen as the pioneers of a new chapter in hip-hop, Snoop and Dre's successful albums became a major factor in the brewing rivalry between the East and West Coast.
Yeah, that East Coast, West Coast shit. It became a real divide in the country with hip-hop, right?
Yeah, it was, because you didn't want to be on the wrong side. And you didn't want to, like for example, if you had friends, right, that was leaning more towards the East Coast, and then you had a friend that really wanted to hear West Coast music, y'all might have ended y'all friendship.
Yeah.
Based off of that.
Really?
It was that serious.
Yeah.
The media played a big role in fueling the rivalry, with gangster rap becoming the main focus of arguments about censorship. Snoop Dogg was often pointed to as an example of musicians promoting violence and misogyny.
If you don't like it, don't listen to it. If you like it, love it. If you don't, f*** you.
The situation wasn't helped when Snoop was slapped with a first-degree murder charge in 1993 for the shooting of a rival gang member. The trial, which lasted until 1996, ended with Snoop being acquitted of all charges, as it was shown that the killing was done by one of his bodyguards in self-defense.
I didn't have no expressions, you know what I'm saying? It was all in her. I prayed on it. My family prayed on it. David Kenner, you know what I'm saying, put on the bomb case. Donald Ray, Marshall Morrissey, Paul Palladino, the whole Dream Team. They did what they were supposed to do, and they gave the baton to the jury, and I couldn't do nothing but just bank on them and worry about what the outcome was going to be, as far as to just sit there and hold my position and keep my head up high and just, you know, wait for the outcome.
And 1996 is also when Snoop released his second studio album, The Dogfather. By then, however, Dr. Dre had already left Death Row Records, and the label wasn't the same as it had been in the years before. Dre had been the heartbeat of Death Row, and without him, The Dogfather emerged as a bloated, shapeless effort that paled in comparison to Snoop's debut. To make matters worse, 1996 was also the year when Tupac Shakur, the label's other crown jewel, was gunned down in a tragic drive-by shooting. A dramatic death that many saw as the brutal but inevitable climax of the feud between the East Coast and the West Coast. All these events, along with Snoop's own brush with a murder trial, forced him to reckon with the darker side of his music, pushing him to distance himself from the gangster rap that had fueled his rise.
I had made a song called Murder Was the Case that was about me losing my life, but before I lost my life, I did cut a deal with the devil, but then God came back and gave me another chance. That was in my mind, but when I wrote it, it just became some gangster shit, but that was the premise behind it. And it was just in my head, like, I want to write a song like this, and then 3 months later, I caught a murder case in real life.
Whoa.
Yes, so my pen was actually writing reality, so I had to pull back from certain things and say, maybe I should start writing about life and living instead of always writing about dying and death.
By March 1998, Snoop Dogg had had enough of Death Row's dark vibe and sought a new beginning. So he made a bold move, leaving the label behind and signing with No Limit Records, ready to carve out a fresh path for himself.
Past is the past, you know what I'm saying? Y'all got enough footage and enough information and documents to let people know what's happening with that. That's a part of my life that I really, you know, try to forget and try to move past, you know what I'm saying? It's like when you were in elementary school, you loved it to reminisce on it, but it's over with, you know what I'm saying? It's over with. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, I know that shit already. Let's move on to algebra, you know what I'm saying? I'm in a new stage right now, a new level of the game, and Death Row was fun while it lasted. It was what it was, but it was more negative than positive. And right now I'm surrounding myself with positivity, so whenever I speak on Death Row, it brings back bad vibes, and I don't really like dwelling on it.
In early 1998, Snoop was on the cover of The Source. The headline was simple: Snoop Dogg wants to leave Death Row. In the interview, Snoop launched an all-out attack on Shoe Knight and Death Row Records. He claimed they'd stopped paying him and were holding him and his music hostage. "That's why I don't give a fuck about Death Row right now," Snoop said. "Just let me go. You hold on to me like I'm a slave or some shit." Just a few weeks later, the big news dropped. Snoop Doggy Dogg was officially joining No Limit Records, but now he was going by a shorter name, just Snoop Dogg. Word on the street was that Master P managed to make it happen by handing Shoe Knight a cool $3 million in cash, plus a share of profits from Snoop's next three albums. It was a solid deal for Knight, but for Snoop, it meant the freedom and fresh start he'd been craving.
Master P went to go visit Suge Knight in the penitentiary, right, and struck a deal because everybody else was scared of that. Everybody, that's when Suge Knight was the monster, the boogeyman. That's when he was the boogeyman.
So P went
to go see him, struck a deal, paid him, paid me, got my publishing back, gave me three albums. I did my three albums.
This was the biggest acquisition in rap history. If you're too young to have been there, this was like LeBron James joining the Miami Heat.
When I signed with No Limit Records, they was the hottest in the rap industry. They was the only getting money in the industry.
Let me finish. I got to say this because this is very important. Please, please.
Puffy and them was rocking, but they wasn't getting no money like Master P was. And I had been around they camp. I had been around Def Jam. I was on Death Row. I had seen all of this. That supposedly had the money. Master P had the motherfucking money.
He was true independent.
He had the money.
When they announced Snoop's debut album for No Limit, The Game Is to Be Sold, Not to Be Told, set to drop on August 4th, 1998, the hype machine went into overdrive. The cover art was slapped together, and the album was pumped out with the relentless efficiency No Limit was known for. But when the album finally dropped, it got a mixed reception. Fans who were hoping for Snoop to stick to his G-Funk roots were surprised to hear him dive headfirst into Southern rap, years before it became mainstream. Instead of familiar faces like Daz, Kurupt, and Warren G, listeners found Snoop trading verses with C-Murder, Mia X, and Soulja Slim. Many weren't ready for such a big shift in sound, but Snoop, always ahead of the curve, knew the South was about to rise in the rap game, and he embraced it fully.
Because my flavor was L.A. It was good that I could, you know, jump out of my habitat and get in this environment and adapt to any environment and be a chameleon.
Thing is, Snoop has a unique ability to always reinvent himself. Every few years, he surprises everyone by trying out new producers, new sounds, and even entirely new genres. This is the guy who gave us a gospel album, rebranded as Snoop Lion for a reggae phase, and made some iconic hits with Pharrell in the mid-2000s. Sure, some folks are quick to label Snoop's No Limit debut a failure, dismissing it as a disjointed, bloated cash grab, but those critics are missing the bigger picture. This album wasn't just a release, it was a rebirth. Snoop was stretching his wings, shaking off the chains of his past, and pushing into new territory. It wasn't smooth sailing, I know, but that's what growth looks like. Most artists never get this kind of second chance. They're shackled by bad contracts, bitter about their stagnation, and end up fading into obscurity, blaming everyone but themselves. Snoop didn't just survive, he thrived. He and Master P saw a golden opportunity in each other and rode it straight into the sunset. A masterclass in marketing and reinvention.
You understand me? He showed me how to put business because I hadn't had a record label. I was always talking that doggy style shit, but I didn't have no record label. Master P showed me how to put a label together, how to go get money, how to eat, how to make money off my tours, how to make money off of movies, how to create a different lane for me to be seen differently. He brought money to the industry, because I'm telling you the truth, having no money.
And it seemed like he didn't try to hold you.
Following the release of this album, Snoop was granted more creative freedom by Master P, which resulted in an album that returned to the sound of his early days, No Limit Top Dog, released in 1999.
It was hot. What's up, Snoop?
I'm chilling. What's up, New York?
Snoop reached out to Dre for some help, marking their first collaboration since Dre's departure from Death Row. Dre produced three tracks on the album, and No Limit Top Dog was generally well-received, earning positive reviews.
And it started to sound back like Snoop Dogg, because the first record was South Like a Motherfucker.
Right.
And the second one was getting more like Snoop Dogg. Then that's when I got Dre to give me Bitch Please. Pharrell gave me From the Church to the Palace. Then I did the third one, which was fucking The Last Meal. That's what shit was.
A year later, Snoop released The Last Meal, which Rolling Stone praised as his best album since Doggy Style.
Feel that, yo, Snoop, a lot of people saying you back, man, but I feel like you never left, man. How you feel about that, man?
I think I'm back because I never left, but I had to, you know, catch a hold of myself and go through a few, you know, changes and, you know, drastic moves that I had to make with myself. And I want to, you know, give a shout out to Master P for, you know, helping me make that move. I want to give a shout out to Death Row Records for showing me what they showed me. And I also want to give a shout out to God for keeping me alive and keeping me doing what I do. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, no, real quick.
When I say it's the last meal, last time, is gonna be eating off me. I wasn't speaking on Master P. I was speaking on these CEOs with the red faces and the, you know, behind the scenes, them guys. You know what I'm saying? Master P is a blessing in disguise. You know, I'm gonna always continue to be down with No Limit Records and whatever he need from me, whatever any of the No Limit soldiers need from me. But Snoop Dogg has to individually blow up Snoop Dogg and Doghouse Records right now.
Yeah,
that's what
it's
all about. You know what I'm saying? I'm in the game, what, 9 years, and it's time for me to build my own foundation and have something to fall back on when I'm through with the game. That's why P scooped me up, so he could show me how to, you know, build my record label and foundate it and not make the mistakes that labels in the past have made. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so, you know, through the game, through P and Death Row and all the game.
Here with his pedigree chum, Pharrell Williams, it's Snoop Dogg, dropping it like it's hot.
2002 marked the start of Snoop's game-changing collaboration with Pharrell. He dropped Paid the Cost to Be the Boss, featuring the massive hit Beautiful. But here's the kicker. Pharrell himself later confessed that he didn't think the song would make waves.
with Snoop, it was like, man, he came in on his tour bus and, you know, he was like, yo, just give me that shit, P. And I was like, okay. And, you know, he would, we were working in there, and then, like, once I was ready, he would come down off his tour bus. Because we were still working in Master Sound at the time. It was Hovercraft. We had Chad and I bought the studio. And he, when he came in, we did Church to Palace. He loved that. And he really loved Beautiful. I didn't get Beautiful. Right. I didn't get Beautiful mainly because I was on there singing flat as fuck. And just didn't hear it. I thought it was a fun record.
Right.
And we put Charlie Wilson on it. I was like, man, Charlie's sounding amazing. And this feels good to me, but no one's ever going to go for this. So, yeah.
Yet, it became one of the defining tracks of Snoop's career, proving once again that the Dogfather knows how to defy expectations. By this point in his career, Snoop Dogg had fully moved away from his gangster image and embraced a new persona, a smooth, laid-back, pimp style that became his signature.
Because it was so connected to who I was, being an ex-gang member and then having that in my music, having that in my lifestyle. So some of the things I had to learn how to gradually grow away from was becoming a burden, because some of these guys were my friends and my homies, and I thought I needed them and I thought they were making me go. But as I grew and got further and further up in the game, I seen that they were more baggage and more of a liability than an asset. And when you learn to be a businessman, it's not personal for me to tell you, hey, Ryan, I love you, but we can't kick it no more, dog. I'm on this path and you on that path. Just like we had to make that decision when we became football players. When we became whatever we became, we had to make the decision of this baggage right here may be the family. It may be the homie. It may be mama. It may be daddy. It may be whoever it is, but we have to make it the ultimate decision to know that we got to carry this baggage and we got to do all of this work, so we need to make sure that our circle is right, starting with us first.
Snoop kept the momentum going in 2004 with the release of R&G, Rhythm, and Gangsta, The Masterpiece. The album featured the absolute banger, Drop It Like It's Hot, another Pharrell collaboration that had everyone turning up the volume.
We at the record plant, he in the back with the keyboards. It's just him and the engineer, and he ain't even got the beat all the way made. He's just like... that part, and he like, I fuck with this. I'm like, what you see? He like, that's how this nigga get out. He don't say words. He just, so it's my job to make that shit make sense, to put words to this.
This track quickly became a staple in Snoop's catalog and showed just how unstoppable his partnership with Pharrell had become.
When you put that motherfucker on there, that was like the candle on the cake. We was like, damn. Mm-hmm.
Guests are a hip-hop supergroup featuring Warren G, Nate Dogg, and Snoop Dogg. This is their debut album entitled The Hard Way. Please welcome 213, ladies and gentlemen.
Snoop kept the hits coming by reuniting with Warren G and Nate Dogg to bring back 213 and release The Hard Way, which debuted at number 4 on the Billboard 200 and number 1 on the top R&B and hip-hop albums chart. He followed this up with a series of successful albums, The Blue Carpet Treatment in 2006, Ego Trippin' in 2008, Malice in Wonderland in 2009, and Dogumentary in 2011. Snoop's journey turned him into a true multimedia star with roles in films, TV shows, and a surprising friendship with Martha Stewart.
I learned so much when I'm with her in the kitchen, etiquette wise, and I learned so much from her business wise, because she's not vocal. So when we doing some shit, say for example if we shooting a commercial and we sitting there for like 2 minutes too long, I'd be like, what the fuck is going on? Let's shoot this motherfucking shot. And then she may not agree with how I said it, but she'd be like
How did your friendship with Snoop come about?
Well, he was on my show, and we hit it off. And we made brownies, and we made other things on my show. And then I went on that Bieber roast.
Martha Stewart's sitting right here. I'm sitting right here. She getting the secondhand smoke.
And I was inhaling his smoke.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
She ends up telling the best fucking jokes out of the night. We end up exchanging numbers.
But in 2012, after a life-changing trip to Jamaica, Snoop embraced Rastafari, once again proving he was a master of reinvention.
Making hip-hop music for the past 22 years, you know, being a gangster rapper, one of the, you know, final frontiers, one of the lead guys in that movement, I just felt like, you know, it was time to say something to, you know, take the party and put it on pause and speak to some real issues and speak to some positivity and some peace and some real struggle in this world right now. You know, it's a lot of issues that we tend to see around the world, but as musicians, we try to not pay attention and make music to make the problem go away. But I didn't want to do that on this project. I wanted to make music to help the problem go away.
On February 4th, 2012, Snoop Dogg made a big announcement. He was releasing a documentary called Reincarnated, along with a new studio album of the same name. But that wasn't all. While in Jamaica, Snoop had a spiritual and artistic awakening that led him to ditch the Snoop Dogg name and embrace a new one, Snoop Lion, given to him by Rastafarian priests. Once again, Snoop was showing the world that when it comes to reinvention, he's the undisputed king.
I want to bury Snoop Dogg and become Snoop Lion.
This new album wasn't a typical hip-hop record. It was a reggae album. Snoop fully embraced his new identity, diving into the rhythms and vibes of reggae, marking an unexpected departure from his usual sound.
I had got to the point in my career that I felt like my music wasn't matching my lifestyle. So I wanted to make some music that represented who I was today as opposed to who I was yesterday. And it felt like reggae music was the perfect music because I was able to speak about peace, love, and struggle. I had no planning on going to Jamaica, making a reggae record or nothing. It just, the spirit called me. And anytime the spirit calls you, you gotta know that it's serious and it's real. So when the spirit called me, it told me to basically find something that was connected towards the Bob Marley spirit, because I've always said that I was Bob Marley reincarnated, and it drew me to Jamaica.
Snoop Dogg, a master of blending wit and swagger, had always wrapped his persona in humor. So when he declared his transformation into Snoop Lion, a reggae singer who casually dubbed himself the reincarnation of Bob Marley, it was hard to take it too seriously. While many found Snoop's reggae transformation entertaining, Bunny Wailer, an original member of Bob Marley and the Wailers, was not amused. Scheduled to appear on the album, Wailer slammed the project, telling TMZ it was outright fraudulent.
You know, Bunny Wailer, who's a former bandmate of Bob Marley, accused you of sort of faking your persona to sell records. What do you think of that and that accusation?
I mean, you know, a lot of old artists are disgruntled because they wasn't paid or either they got done wrong, and they usually take it out on the youngsters who are having success and who are positive. But it doesn't bother me because my thing is making music, and I know the only way to match his negativity is with positivity.
But Bunny Wailer wasn't alone in his outrage. The Ethio-Africa Diaspora Union Millennium Council, better known as the Rastafari Millennium Council, took it a step further, firing off a scathing 7-page letter to Snoop. They didn't mince words, claiming, "Smoking weed and loving Bob Marley and reggae music is not what defines the Rastafari indigenous culture.
Now, you could have made music, though, over a hip-hop beat. You could have made music at Snoop Dogg. You could have made positive music like a Mose or a Kwali or a Common. But you took a whole different musical turn, too.
I don't think I could have ever done that as Snoop Dogg, because Snoop Dogg is who he is. He's that. He's cut from that cloth.
Yeah.
But Snoop Lion is the progression of Snoop Dogg. He's the growth into the maturity and has a third eye, and he's able to speak on issues that Snoop Dogg couldn't speak on because Snoop Dogg was a part of the problem and Snoop Lion is a part of the solution.
Musically, Major Lazer's production on the album is stellar, and as a pop reggae project, it's passable. But there's a constant sense that Snoop is chasing something that's just out of his reach. The harsh reality is that Snoop is no reggae singer, and his performances are bogged down by clumsy vocals and fortune cookie wisdom. To his credit, he smartly brings in a team of singers and true reggae artists to provide the hooks and credibility he's missing. However, the end result feels like Snoop is hanging out in the background while the pros handle the heavy lifting. In September of the same year, Snoop took on yet another identity, DJ Snoopadelic, and released a compilation of electronic music called Loose Joints. A year later, he rebranded himself as Snoopzilla and collaborated with Damn Funk on 7 Days of Funk.
I don't worry about what people say. As long as I feel good, I'm gonna keep doing it.
However, both projects barely registered on the charts, and probably some of you didn't even know they existed until now.
So what do you want people to call you? Because you went from Snoop Dogg to Snoop Lion to Snoopzilla and then Finding Nemo, a.k.a. Nemo Ho. Well, so what should they call you when they approach
call me
you?
Snoop, you know what I'm saying? That makes it simple. But the thing is that, you know, for the project, you know, it wasn't a Snoop Dogg project, so I didn't want people to get it confused. That's why it was a project called 7 Days of Funk, where it's me and Dame Funk. We came together and created a group. And in the group, the name that I'm, you know, under is Snoopzilla. But, you know, it's for the cause of the group, setting the purpose on making some good folk music and some good records that feel good to us that eventually feel good to you.
By 2015, Snoop was back to his Snoop Dogg roots, dropping almost an album a year with reviews that ranged from mixed to generally positive. The real story here, though, is Snoop's longevity. Considering how long he's been in the game, maintaining this level of output is nothing short of remarkable.
You've managed to make a career out of being yourself.
Right.
That's where it's amazing.
Yeah, but that's the easiest job everybody got, just to wake up in the morning and do you.
Yeah, but so many people have a hard time doing that publicly.
Right, because it's so easy to want to be like something that's out there that feels like it's easier to do and it's more impressionable and it's an easy follow. But when you wake up and do yourself, that's just the organic thing that you were built with that you know how to do in your sleep.
In 2018, Snoop got his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, but the true crowning achievement of Snoop's eternal career and his enduring bond with Dr. Dre was his performance at the 2022 Super Bowl halftime show, sharing the stage with Dre, Eminem, 50 Cent, Mary J. Blige, and Kendrick Lamar.
Dr. Dre is one of my closest associates, so when I knew he got the call, I was figuring that I was going to get a call soon. But to add Eminem, Kendrick, and Mary J. Blige is like special, because it's like this is his super friends, and this is his Super Bowl moment to actually show people why he is, you know, who he is.
But the story doesn't end there. On February 10th, 2022, Snoop found closure with a significant chapter of his life when he announced that he had acquired Death Row Records with plans to revive the iconic label. And in a fitting full circle moment, Snoop also teased a new album, Missionary, produced entirely by Dr. Dre, showing that his creative partnership with Dre is far from over.
The first album I've done with Snoop was in 1993, and it's the only album I've ever produced on Snoop, right? 30 years ago. So now, believe it or not, we're getting together again, and we're almost done with the album. The first album was called Doggy Style. So we decided to flip it and call this one Missionary.
Hey.
That's Jimmy's favorite position.
That's your favorite position?
Jimmy's been a missionary for 30 years.
For most people under 30, except maybe for diehard classic rap fans, Snoop Dogg's murder charge and highly publicized trial have largely faded from memory. Instead, he's now seen by many Gen Z as the friendly face of an earlier era of rap. Snoop Dogg isn't the first, and he won't be the last celebrity to reclaim the public's favor after a troubled past. Just look at Robert Downey Jr., Winona Ryder, and Martha Stewart. All of them have weathered their own scandals and emerged stronger, not just surviving, but thriving with high-profile careers and lucrative brand partnerships. In an ironic twist on that famous Dark Knight quote, the villain has lived long enough to become the hero. Snoop Dogg, once the face of controversy, is now officially a family-friendly entertainer with undeniable cross-generational appeal. His transformation is so thorough that he was invited to take center stage at the 2024 Olympics, essentially becoming a U.S. mascot. This moment serves as the ultimate validation of his journey from controversy to beloved icon.
One thing about the Olympics is that it brings everybody together, all countries together, all people together through competition, but peace and love is the end goal. We come to have a great time and we plan to leave on a good time.
Snoop is inherently likable. Despite coming from a violent hip-hop background that some find difficult to navigate, Snoop breaks the mold. He's both comical and playful, creating a fascinating contrast that resonates with the masses.